1992. I was 14 years old. And you know, 14-year-old, you're just growing. Everything's growing. And so I needed new shoes halfway through the school year. And my mom takes me shopping. And I grew up in a modest family where, lived on a farm. We didn't spend a lot of money on those things. But at this point in my life, there were no shoes, plural. There was one shoe that I wanted. I wanted Generation 7 Air Jordan Raptors more than anything else. And so we go to the store, and Mom's like showing me like these, you know, these old man shoes and stuff. And I'm like, Mom, Mom, please, you know, I'll get beat up for that. And I said, there's no other shoe, Mom. This is what I want. And she looks at the price tag. They're on sale for $130. This is 20 years ago. On sale for $130. And I'm like, Mom's like, there is no way. This better come with a whole outfit. And big, what? And I'm like, I said, so, Mom, you know, I'm 14 years old. I'm an expert negotiator at that point. Okay, Mom, here's the deal. Like, how much would you usually pay for my shoes? Okay, so you'll pay this much. You know, I've been working. I've been mowing lawns and stuff. I'll pay whatever's on top. And my mom was like, this is the stupidest idea ever. Who would ever pay that much for a pair of shoes? And so I did, though. And I came home with my Air Jordans, and I was just like, I was the giddiest. I never enjoyed an item of clothing like I enjoyed that. It was like a highlight of my 14 years of life. Now, I say all that to say, I wasn't even a basketball fan, but this is the effect that Michael Jordan had on me and all my friends. He transcended basketball. It wasn't just that he was a good basketball player. He was. He had, the league title for scoring 10 years, 6 NBA championships, 5 MVPs, 2 Olympic gold medals. I mean, obviously a good basketball player. But it wasn't about that so much. It was about young men all over in my generation in the 80s and 90s, when we watched Michael Jordan, we knew that this is awesome. This has potential. This is what I could become like. And it's not even about basketball, but it's beyond that. It's just the idea of human potential there. It's the idea of you can conquer, that you could be the best at something. We all wanted to be like Mike. And I say this to say, recently, 2013, this February, ESPN came out with an article. Now, at this point, they're still selling Air Jordans amazingly. It's a billion-dollar industry at this point. Still selling them, but Michael Jordan's been retired from the NBA for over 10 years. And he turned 50 years old in February, so ESPN showed up and they said, we really want to do an interview with you. You know, what's it like being a 50-year-old at this point? Like, what's this transition like and dealing with reality and aging? A guy who peaked, who's had everything you could imagine in life by the age of 35, every possible victory. You know, what's life like? So they sat down to do this interview, and let me read you some of this. There's a quote. It says, Michael Jordan stopped playing basketball, but the rage is still there. The fire remains, which is why he searches for release on the golf course or at a blackjack table, why he spends so much time and energy on the Charlotte Bobcats, the team that he owns, and why he dreams of returning to play. And then the rest of the article is about how absolutely miserable Michael Jordan is. Jordan's self-esteem has always been, as he says, tied directly to the game. Without it, he feels adrift. Who am I? What am I doing? For the past 10 years since retiring for the third time, he's been running, moving as fast as he could, creating distractions and distance. He says he would go to his office and say, hey, I don't want any phone calls for a month. I'm just going to take the time off. But 3 days later, he couldn't stand it. He would call them up and say, we got to do something else. We got to come up with another program. He'd call for the private jet, and he'd have to go on another trip. He'd have to conquer something else. He feels his competitiveness kick in, almost a chemical thing, he says. And he starts working out and wonders, Could I play at 50? How would I take on LeBron? What if it's consumed so much of me, he says, I'm my own worst enemy. I drove myself so much that I'm still living with some of those drives. I'm living with that. I don't know how to get rid of it. I don't know if I could. And then he goes on to describe that turning to alcohol and gambling was actually the only way he could stop himself. The only way he could numb that insatiable drive within him. The only way he could quench the fire a little bit. At one point, he says he never imagined he'd live this long. He always thought he'd die young because he has no idea what to do with his life at this point. Towards the end of the interview, he wonders out loud, listen to this, how can I enjoy the next 20 years of my life without so much of this consuming me? How can I find peace away from the game of basketball? And he has no answer, none. The very man who inspired my whole generation to live life to the fullest has no idea what to do with his life. And the words of Solomon, are you kidding me? Like, if Michael Stinking Jordan can't be happy in life, the center of a billion-dollar industry, the man with private jet, the man who's won every possible award, the man who has everything anyone could ever want, the man who said in the last 30 years he's never walked into a room where he didn't feel like he was the most important person in the room. When that man can't find any happiness in life, what are poor schmucks like us supposed to do? Michael Jordan has no idea. The good news, Solomon does. Solomon's going to talk about not so much just how to be happy in life, but today he's going to talk more about how not to be happy. It's like he's going to save us. If we would listen carefully today, we're going to hear some things that will save us from becoming like Michael Jordan, although I don't think any of you are afraid of that right now, but save us from chasing something that will never bring you true happiness. We're in Ecclesiastes chapter 6. If you have your Bible, feel free to jump there with me, or if you have your phone, turn there. Ecclesiastes chapter 6. He's going to describe Michael Jordan to a T here. I want you to listen to this. I have seen another evil under the sun, and it weighs heavily on mankind. God makes some people like Michael Jordan. Listen to this guy. God gives them wealth and possessions and honor so that they lack nothing their hearts desire. They have a private jet. They're the center of a billion-dollar industry. They're the most important person in every room they show up in for 30 years. But God does not grant them the ability to enjoy this. And strangers enjoy them instead. This is meaningless, a grievous evil. Solomon says right off the bat here, if you're looking for happiness, you can have everything, but if you don't enjoy it, who cares? The key word here is the word enjoy. We're going to see this come up again and again and again here. The Hebrew often uses word pictures. And the word enjoy literally is the idea of filling your stomach or taking a great big gulp of water and being satisfied. Like you enjoy it, like it just hit the spot. So here's the picture. Throughout the Bible, we're going to find that our physical appetites are often compared to all of our appetites. It's like a metaphor for all of them. So King David, when he talks about his desire for God, what does he say? I hunger for you. I thirst for you. Now, he doesn't literally want to eat God, but you get the idea. And the same thing. Okay, here's my favorite. Song of Solomon. It's the big night. Bride. Groom. They're looking at each other, and their clothes just came off. And what's the chorus sing? Eat, oh lovers. Drink deeply. And then the guy, you got to read Hebrew to read it this way, but it literally says, if you were honey, I would eat you. If you were a glass of wine, I would be drunk right now. Like this idea, this metaphor, that physical appetites represent all of our appetites. They represent our desires.
So what we're coming to here is this is the image that Solomon says some guys, they walk through life and it's like an all-you-can-eat buffet. And they've got their plate out and they've just loaded that thing up. That some guys, like their life is like a Brazilian steakhouse. You know what a Brazilian steakhouse is? I've shared this once before. It's genius. It's a little bit of heaven. Like you go in, you sit down, and you have this little tab thing you flip. And if it's green, that means go. So when they come over with the perfectly cooked fillets, with the chops, the perfectly seasoned meat, they just keep sawing it off till you say stop. It's awesome. So imagine you're sitting there. You take this guy out for dinner, and it's a Brazilian steakhouse, and there's all these sexy Brazilians cutting off steaks, and there you go. You sit down, and then you see the guy's just pushing the food around on his plate, and you say, what's the matter? He says, I'm a vegetarian. That's what this is like. Like, you just gave, God just gave you the best meal you could ever enjoy, and you say, don't really like it. Not really my thing. If you want to see how messed up we are, Solomon says we need to stop and think. And this is particularly true for us. First world Westerners, where we live, we have more than anyone else. Like, we spend more, literally, on dog food and going out to eat than other nations spend at total income. And yet we are so unhappy. Solomon says, do you want to know how messed up we are? God blesses us ridiculously. He loads up our plate stupidly bountiful with all these good things. And then we say, I don't really have a taste for that. This is meaningless. This is a grievous evil. It shows how wicked our hearts are. Verse 3. A man may have 100 children and live many years. So here's the picture. A guy can have 100 kids and live for 100 years. Okay, 100 kids just sounds absolutely exhausting and expensive in our world, right? Like, but in that context, this is the picture of ancient Near Eastern blessing. That children were an opportunity. They were a blessing from the Lord. Psalm 127 says, that children are a blessing from the Lord, sons heritage from the Lord, 100 kids in a long life. This guy, he is the Michael Jordan of the ancient Near East. He has everything you could possibly want. Now, to put this in perspective, kids back then actually made money for you. They didn't cost money, they made money for you. So the more kids you had, the wealthier you were. It was your insurance, it was your wealth. Every child in every year of life was viewed as an opportunity from God. An opportunity to gain wealth, an opportunity to share your life, an opportunity to grow, an opportunity to watch your kids mature and develop into men and women. An opportunity to someday walk your little girl down the aisle with a guy that you hopefully like. An opportunity to spoil rotten grandkids. An opportunity to show up with a big family in church someday and be the old guy who says, it's too hot in here and the music too loud. I want to be that guy someday. It says every year and every child is an opportunity, a gift from God. But watch this. You can be the Michael Jordan of the ancient Near East and have every possible opportunity, yet, no matter how long he lives, if he cannot enjoy his prosperity, and if he does not receive a proper burial, I say that a stillborn child is better off than he. If he doesn't enjoy his life, if he doesn't receive a proper burial, it would be better that he was miscarried, better that he was never born. Now, this is uncomfortable. It's a little uncomfortable because miscarriage is so common. So many people have been hurt by it. Have you ever had one of those conversations where you're like, someone says something that's offensive and rude, and you're just like, okay, just drop it. But they won't. They just keep on going. This is Solomon right here. It, the baby, comes without meaning. It departs in darkness, and in darkness its name is shrouded. Though it never saw the sun or knew anything, it has more rest, more shalom than does that man. Even if he lives 1,000 years twice over but fails to enjoy his prosperity, do not all go to the same. Aren't we all just going to die? Before we just chalk this off as some ancient Near Eastern oddity, I want you to take just a moment and place yourself in Solomon's very expensive shoes. Air Jordans of the ancient Near East, I'm sure. I want you to remember his family. You know, his father was who? King David. And King David did have many, many children. Children that we don't even know all the names of his children. He had many wives and many children. But there was one birth, or not one pregnancy in particular, that stands out in all of his kids. Do you know who it was? It was the baby that was never born. It was Solomon's older sibling. That when David slept with Bathsheba, she had a baby, right? She got pregnant, but that baby died. It was a stillborn child. And we don't have Bathsheba's response, but we do know that David himself was tore up about this. That though that baby was never born, he loved that baby. Solomon knows that it's possible for parents to love a baby that's never been born. But he says, now when you compare that type of love to a guy who has 100 kids but doesn't receive proper burial, here's the deal with that. Proper burial was not just some like, it wasn't like, oh, your life is meaningless if you have a bad funeral. It's not that. The proper burial was a sign of respect and honor and love in that culture. I mean, even you see in, 1 Samuel chapter 11, David goes out and kills all these people. It's a big battle. Armies clash. All these enemies strewn on the field. And then what happens? Well, Joab, the general, goes back to bury them all. I mean, sure, they're enemies. Sure, you want them dead. But at least you're going to bury them. I mean, it's just the respectful thing to do. Later, we see in God's law in Deuteronomy chapter 21, you see if there's the worst possible person you can imagine is executed, a rapist, a murderer, a terrorist, what does God say? He says, they might be a rapist, they might be a terrorist, they might be a murderer, they might deserve death, but you don't leave their body out to rot. You're going to respect them. You're going to bury them. Solomon just said that you might have 100 kids and live 100 years, but if at the end of your very long life there is not one person who respects you, there's not one person who loves you, it would be better that you were never born. Because he's seen a parent's love for an unborn child. But to go through life and destroy every relationship, that's an unspeakable evil. The quality of your life is more important than the quantity. Respect and love are more important than the number of kids or length of life. So, if you're Michael Jordan, if God gives you every possible opportunity, this does not mean that you will enjoy life the way that God intended. True value of life can't be measured by how much you have or how many relationships you have or how long you live. True value of life cannot be measured by how long you live, how much you have, or how many Facebook friends you have. That's not it. He's measuring it in love. He's measuring it in respect. He's measuring it in godliness and honor. So here's the deal. We all have opportunities before us. Some of us do have the Michael Jordan type life of our own field. Some of us have, our life is the Brazilian steakhouse, you know, version of life. And some of us have a McDonald's life. We do. Some of us, we're just lucky to get fries with that. But the thing is that he's going to say, the chances are that you can have a lot of things or you can have a little things. That does not decide the quality of your life. You know, God's probably not giving you 100 children. Whew. It'd be good for our children's ministry, though. He's probably not giving you 100 children, but here's the deal. If you're here right now, you have relationships you can invest in. And you know what? God might not let you live 100 years, but here's the thing. You have today. That he's going to say, you might not have any of that, but all of us have opportunities before us. And the question is not, do you have those opportunities? The question is, what are you doing with the opportunities that God has given you? Are you going to increase your love and respect and godliness, or are you going to increase your appetites? Look at verse 7 here. Everyone's toil is for their mouth, yet their appetite is never satisfied. This is what Michael Jordan talked about, the fire within him that it constantly consumed him. He just had to have more, had to have more. Here he's saying that everyone is working so hard to pile up their plate of goods, thinking that that's going to make them happy. But it doesn't work like that. You know that will never work because you will never find happiness by feeding your desires. Here's the great irony that all of us, like I remember reading this, the first time I read it in Thomas Aquinas, Imitation of Christ. And it's this simple line, choose, if you want inward peace, if you want to know what will make you happy, the first line is this, choose less rather than more. Choose to be last and least of all. That stuff, making yourself first, being the most important person in the room, does not bring true happiness. The irony of this is that the more you actually feed your desires, the more they grow. So when you start out, you can spend your life just feeding every desire. Like, oh, I want that, and I want to be that. And if you're good, and if, like us, okay, we have education, and we have money, and we have friends. You're fairly connected if you're here. We all have these opportunities. So if we really want something in life, all of us can have everything we need, and most of us can have almost everything we want. So you can just chase it and chase it and chase it. Here's the deal. The more you chase, the more you want. And if you chase every desire, if you say yes to every desire, the scriptures actually say that what inverts is what you think is your desires are serving you, but it inverts. Soon you're serving your desires, that they actually enslave you. The scriptures are going to put it this way. In this fallen world, our natural inclination is to be mastered by our desires. That the more we simply obey our desires and do whatever they ask, the more they're going to ask. So it starts out where a guy says, "Daggone it, you can't tell me what to do. You can't tell me I've got to give away things and it's mine to spend and I have the capability. I can take whatever I want." He says, "You know what? If I want to drink a drink, I can. If I want to look at something on the internet that you say I shouldn't, I can do whatever I want. If I want to chase that career, I can. If I want to do whatever I want, I can do it." And you say, okay. So it's true. He goes out, he has a drink, looks at some porn, works long hours to pursue his career. And at the first, it's just his freedom. He can do whatever he wants. But if he keeps on doing that, it gets to a day where he doesn't have a choice. He has to have that drink. He looks at the porn whether he enjoys it or not. He has to chase that career. It's his whole life because those things form habits. And habits, if left alone, form addictions. And addictions and habits eventually form character. It's who you are. You're formed by the desires you say yes to. Here's the question. Your character is not formed in some grand decision, although that can help. It's not formed by some super emotion, although that can be useful. It's formed by millions of small decisions every day. Questions like, am I going to watch that channel on TV? Am I going to look at that? Am I going to spend that money on that? Can I say no to my desires? If you spend your life chasing your desires, you're going to end up like Solomon. Watch this, verse 8. What advantage have the wise over the fools? Here he's talking about someone. Imagine someone who has everything in life and is super wise and spends all of their time saying yes to every desire. That's Solomon. If you know his story, you know that's exactly what happened to him. This was a guy who could have anything he wants, so he took it. And what does he take? He takes 700 wives. My friend, at a certain point, that goes from love to lust. And this great king of everyone in the world is now a slave to lust. And if you look how that works out in his life, not only destroys his life at the end, it destroys the nation. The whole nation self-destructs because he couldn't say no. What do the poor gain by knowing how to conduct themselves before others? This is, have you guys seen that movie, The Pursuit of Happiness with Will Smith? That's what this is talking about. So Solomon says, what if there's a poor guy who really knows how to get ahead in life? What if there's a homeless guy who through hard work, brilliance, diligence, can chase and chase and work and work and work and become a Wall Street executive? Now you would think that'd be something, but Solomon says, here's the deal. If he gets to that point and all he can do is chase and chase and chase and want more and more and more, the fact of the matter is he might be on Wall Street or he might be sleeping under a bridge, but he is going to have the mindset and the happiness of a homeless man. He will never be satisfied. If you have to constantly satisfy your desires, if you have to constantly climb the ladder, you will get to the top. But you won't be any wealthier, not in God's eyes. Better what the eyes see than the roving of the appetite. This too is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. This right here, it literally says, better what the eyes see, better is what is right in front of you, than literally it says, than the goings of the soul. The goings of the soul. So, Imagine if you would, where a wife comes to talk to her husband, she wants to share something with him, and they have this long conversation. She's right in front of him, but the whole time he's looking through her saying, and his soul is somewhere else. Now, I know this wouldn't happen in this room, but imagine having a conversation with someone and you know they are not there. Their soul is somewhere else. Imagine someone having a day off from work where they're supposed to spend the day with their family, but they decide, I'm just going to check this one email or this one text, and they spend the rest of the day and their soul solving problems, fighting fights, analyzing things. You know what Solomon says here? He says, you know what's better than all the things you can dream about, than all the other places you could be, is what's right in front of you. Like, if you would just stop and enjoy what's in front of you, that's the gift from God. That so many of us go through all of our lives waiting for the next thing, dreaming the next dream, and we could possibly go through all of life and miss what's right in front of us. When's the last time you were fully present? When's the last time you like tasted your food? You actually smelled what the air smells like in the spring? When's the last time you looked at your spouse and thought, wow, she's pretty hot. Wow, he's good looking. When's the last time you just enjoyed your kids and wasn't worried about the next thing? Solomon says, if you want to experience what God has to give you, look right in front of you. If you're not careful, you're going to achieve all of your dreams and all of your desires only to realize that you missed out on the very best things of life. If you hope to ever be fully present in this moment, though, if you hope to ever truly enjoy this life, not the life of your dreams, but the life that God is actually giving you, there's one caveat here that he's going to say, then you have to come to peace with the life that God is actually giving you. Watch this, verse 10. Whatever exists has already been named, and what humanity is has been known. This is a simple biblical language, to name and to know. This is biblical language for God's sovereignty. Here's the deal. God's already called it. He's already decided who you're going to be and what you're going to be in life. God's already called your life. Like, he gave you these opportunities. He's already presenting them for you. Are you going to be at peace with this? Here's the deal. Before I was ever born, God said, Paul Daniel Anderson, 1978. He's going to be the first baby born in Champaign County, Ohio. He's going to tan really well. He's going to have a really good head of hair. But to keep him humble, I'm going to give him like woman-sized hands and feet. I'm going to make him really good at dancing. But then oddly, every time he picks up a musical instrument, it's actually going to be like embarrassing, awkward. Like, I'm going to prepare a life for him. I'm going to give him the ability to preach. But when it comes to basketball, he's going to miss 10 out of 10 shots. Like, I know he wants his parents who can just buy Air Jordans for him, but I'm going to give him parents that make him work for it. Here's the deal. I couldn't decide any of those things. These are opportunities that God gave me. And Solomon asks this question, are you going to be at peace with who you are, with the opportunities that God has given you? Like, you might not tan like me, and you might be really good at music and musical instruments. Are you going to be at peace with what God has given you? Now, I want to be careful here. This is about God's sovereignty, but what I'm not saying is that I'm not saying that I don't have a responsibility in life. I do. You and I both have opportunities that are given from God, and you and I have a choice. How am I going to respond to this opportunity that God's given me? Like, I could throw it away or I can make the most out of it. But here's the deal. You don't get to choose the opportunities. God chooses the opportunities. You just get to choose how to respond to what God puts right in front of you. Solomon's going to say this, make peace with this. Why? Because no one can contend with someone stronger. That God decided this long ago, before the universe ever was created. He decided these opportunities for you. Now you can come to peace with it, or you can try and fight with God. But let me tell you something, you're going to lose. Somewhere along the way, in American idealism, we came up with this really, really pleasant but unhelpful myth that you can be whatever you want to be. Parents, I just warn you how you speak to your kids here. You cannot be whatever you want to be. It's just not true. I might want to be like Michael Jordan, but my vertical is like an inch. Like, my height peaked at 12 years old. Like, I have no chance. None. And if I pursue that, if that's my absolute dream in life, to be like Michael Jordan, I will be nothing but disappointed. But if I accept that I'm a well-tanned preacher, man, I could be a well-tanned preacher and I could enjoy that. Solomon says that some things we don't get to decide. You have to decide, though, are you going to accept what God has given you? Are you going to waste your life arguing? Watch this. This is what it looks like to argue with God. It says, the more words, the less the meaning, and how does that profit anyone? So you can fight all day long, all for the rest of your life. You can be so mad that God made you short, or that God didn't let you tan well, or that God made you slow, or that God made you fat, or that God made you tall. You can be mad about everything, but the fact of the matter is, what does that profit anyone? You gain nothing from that. At the end of the day, you are just more unhappy. And here's the deal. I can spend my life frustrated about this, where I can be fully present with what God has actually given me. You know, we might feel it's unfair that God didn't make us wealthy or didn't do this or didn't do that for us. Some of you grew up in very tragic situations, and you might feel it's unfair that I grew up in that situation. Why me? Why did I not get that? Some of you grew up in really blessed situations. Here's the deal. If you spend your days arguing with God about what he didn't give you, about the opportunities you didn't get, the real problem is that you think you know better than God. Because I think I know better than God a lot too. And as much as I hate to admit it, Solomon's going to say, we don't. God knows what a good life is. God knows what a good life is. He knows how long you're going to live. He knows whether a few days as a baby is a good life or whether 100 years is a good life. God's ultimately the one who's going to judge this. Watch this. For who knows what is good for a person in life during the few and meaningless days that they pass through life like a shadow? Who knows what a good life is? We all thought that Michael Jordan's life was the perfect life. We all wanted to be like Mike. But he says, who knows what a good life is? And the answer is, God alone knows. Who can tell them what will happen under the sun after they are gone? Who knows what happens to us in eternity? Who knows what our lives actually mean in the scheme of things? And the answer is, you don't, and I don't either. But God does. Some people call this chapter the most pessimistic chapter in the whole of Scriptures. You can see why. He just went through this laundry list of everything that won't make you happy. It's not about the money you make. It's not about the success you have. It's not about how long you live. It's not about how many friends you have. It's not about your dreams and aspirations. None of that matters in the end. Here's the question he's going to leave us with. Will you trust God? Will you trust God that what he put in front of you, the opportunity he actually gave you, that's good enough, that's going to be good? Will you trust God that the money and the length of life that he gives you, that's good? Or are you always going to be fighting against God, saying, why didn't I get that opportunity? Are you going to be fully present in your life right now? Are you always going to be dreaming about the next thing? So the question is, how are we supposed to enjoy life? And we got this laundry list. It's not more stuff. It's not more relationships. It's not a longer life. It's not satisfying every desire. The question is, will you trust God that he knows best? Will you delight yourself in him and dwell in the land? Will you trust him to fulfill your desires instead of chasing all of your desires on your own? Will you trust this? Will you trust that Jesus' life, a life of poverty, a life of self-control, a life that ended prematurely, I'm older than Jesus was when he died. Will you trust that is what a good life looks like? Are you going to cling to your own view? Do you think you know best? Do you think you know what a good life is? Will you trust God's promise that Jesus' way, the way of suffering, the way of submission, the way of love, is better than the way of conquering and victory and success and envy? Will you trust that Jesus' life is the life of ultimate enjoyment, and ultimately what we call resurrection? Are you trusting yourself to build your own legacy, to make yourself eternal? I only want to leave you with one question. Do you still want to be like Mike? or do you want to be like Jesus? That's the question we all have to answer.